This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 23 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Fruling, and with me today, as he always is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing aspects of Vulcan philosophy, such as logic and edict, infinite diversity and infinite combinations, and we'll be discussing the philosophical underpinnings of Vulcan philosophy here in the real world. Well, Mike, welcome to the show today.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. I'm looking forward to this because this is kind of a Vulcan episode for us.
Well, Mike, here on Metatrex, we kind of have a Vulcan theme going. We have a Vulcan edict symbol as our logo for our podcast, and we have an audio bumper from Tim Russ at the beginning of the show. And, of course, it's a show on Star Trek and philosophy, and what's more Vulcan than logic? And, of course, philosophy is the main discipline where you get the science of logic. So, you know, here on Metatrex, we kind of have a Vulcan theme going. So I'm excited to finally dive in and start talking about some actual Vulcan philosophy here after 20-something weeks of doing Metatrex together.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. In particular, edict or idic, as some people refer to it. I say edict, or if you're Vulcan, it's kol ut shan in the Vulcan language, which stands for, as you said, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And we actually get that, Zachary, from one of my favorite animated series episodes, The Infinite Vulcan. There are two really good Vulcan episodes. I'm just going to throw them out there right off the bat, from the animated series. Yesteryear, is a particular fan favorite, and The Infinite Vulcan, which, as I believe was written by, Walter Koenig, that's where we get infinite diversity and infinite combination, symbolizing the elements that create truth and beauty. And Zachary, you mentioned the idict symbol that dons our cover art. The idict symbol, we understand, was a representation of Serac's enlightenment atop Mount Seleia. So we're going to talk about enlightened Vulcans in this episode, and that's always a great subject.
Well, Mike, I was thinking through just different aspects of Vulcan philosophy, just trying to put together a very small list of what are some of the defining characteristics of Vulcan philosophy. And of course, I'm a philosopher, so I'm trying to think, what are the connections to philosophy here in the real world? You know, where did the roots of this idea of Vulcan philosophy come from here in the real world? And of course, I have interesting questions about whether these connections we're going to make today are intentional or whether they're purely accidental, whether we're reading a lot into Vulcan philosophy here from the real world. I don't really know the answers to those questions. I haven't looked at it very deeply. If I had a little more time to spend on it, I'd like to do an interesting deep dive and see how much of these connections we're going to make were actually written into Vulcan philosophy from the beginning. But as I think through some of the things that are defining of Vulcan philosophy, I think of things like, obviously, there's the suppressed emotion, right? And so Vulcans have this kind of Vulcan stoicism. It's not that they don't have emotions, it's that they make a conscious effort to suppress them in favor of logical reasoning. And it creates an interesting tension in characters like Spock, you know, who does have emotional pullings, but he's trying to suppress them for the sake of living a Vulcan lifestyle. So, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind right off the bat is just this Vulcan stoicism.
No, you know, when I think of Vulcans, I think of that stoicism. That's one of the first things that comes to mind. And, you know, it's funny, Zachary, because in the original series, we're introduced to the character of Spock, and I think it's pretty universal. Spock really represents the quintessential Vulcan. When anybody thinks of a Vulcan in the Star Trek universe, I can't imagine As much as we all love Tuvok, and as much as we all love T'Pol, as much as we all love Dr. Salar, I do love Dr. Salar. Spock is actually the first Vulcan that comes to mind, and that stoicism is really something that marked his character. His ability to not feel emotion, and that's one of the common misconceptions in the Star Trek universe about Vulcans, is that it's not that they don't feel the emotions, but they've learned to suppress them. And I didn't really realize in many years of fandom until I got around to watching Star Trek Voyager that I really got to see the Vulcan people as a very spiritual people. I find that very interesting. And it's really in their spirituality that they have learned to suppress emotion and to maintain that sense of stoicism.
Yeah, it's fascinating you mentioned that, Mike, because, you know, on my list here of aspects of Vulcan philosophy, at the very top of my list, besides the stoicism that I mentioned, is logical deduction, right? Vulcans are logical. That's the thing that everyone knows about Vulcans. And what does that mean? And as I was trying to think, okay, what does it mean for a Vulcan to be logical? And how does this come into the picture in terms of Vulcan philosophy? It's funny you mention, the sort of Vulcan faith or Vulcan religion or Vulcan spirituality. Because I was thinking of a scene in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. It's a discussion between Spock and Valeris. I think it's in Valeris's quarters. I can't quite remember, but basically Spock is telling Valeris that she has to have faith that the universe will unfold as it should. And he also tells her that logic is the beginning of wisdom, not its end. And that's a fascinating thing for a Vulcan to say, because this is clearly an older, wiser Spock who's realized there's more to life than just logic. While I don't really want to focus on Vulcan spirituality so much today, I want to focus on the philosophy. You can see really this older, wiser Spock that's realized he's managed to find a way to blend his human side and his Vulcan side together. He's got he's found a way to sort of incorporate other aspects of his life besides pure logic into his being. It's kind of a stark contrast between the Spock you see in Star Trek VI and the Spock you see in Star Trek the Motion Picture, where Spock is trying to purge himself of all emotion, and now he's managed to find a way to really blend the two and become comfortable with that himself. But this scene really fascinates me because it occurred to me there's really more to Vulcan philosophy than we're understanding. If Spock is saying, look, logic is the beginning of wisdom, not its end. Well, what is the end of wisdom then? What is the view of the universe as a whole whereby you can say that you have to have faith that the universe will unfold as it should? If it's not purely just sort of speculative spirituality, right? You know, just sort of, you know, pacifying yourself and making yourself comfortable with this, you know, universe that's unpredictable. There must be something deeper to that. And it got me thinking, well, a lot of the things that Spock has to say in that discussion sound like the philosopher, the modern philosopher, the rationalist modern philosopher, Baruch Spinoza from the 1700s. So it got me thinking that there's more here than meets the eye, that a lot of the roots of Vulcan philosophy really can be found in the Western rationalist tradition. And by rationalist, I mean the group of philosophers that attempt to gain knowledge or wisdom or understanding using pure reason alone, pure intellect, as opposed to empiricist philosophers who tried to think that knowledge was from the senses or from experience. And so Spinoza was a rationalist. And you'd expect Vulcans to be rationalists, right? They emphasize logic so much, you'd expect them to use pure reason alone to try to come up with knowledge. And it just got me thinking that, hey, Vulcans are really like modern day futurist Spinozan philosophers.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mentioned to you in Turbolift that I have a copy of Spinoza very similar to what you have there. In fact, I think mine was just a copy of the actual papers that you have. And interestingly enough, I remember a conversation with the professor when he was handing them out, and he actually introduced Spinoza by saying, it's commonly thought that Spock is the father of logic. However, I want to introduce you to Spinoza, who is actually here on Earth the father of logic.
Well, like I mentioned, Mike, this philosopher Spinoza was a rationalist, which means he thought that knowledge could be attained through pure reason alone. And I haven't cracked this book open in probably 15 years since I was in college, maybe when I was TAing an intro to philosophy course that, where we were using primary sources or something. It's been probably 15 years, and I had to kind of remind myself, how does he start off this great work? So the book I'm looking at right now is called Ethics. It's Spinoza's main work. It's just called Ethics. And what's fascinating to me is the whole thing reads like a Euclidean geometry proof. He starts out by defining his terms, defining his axioms, and then he has proofs, and he's just trying to deduce further things that have to be true based on these definitions and based on these axioms. And he builds this really grandiose metaphysical system based solely on a few definitions and a few key terms. And if I was thinking, how would Vulcan's do philosophy? It would read very much like this. You know, let's start out by defining our terms. Let's see what things we can deduce. Let's have some helpful explanation along the way. It's not an impassioned way of doing philosophy. It's supposed to be cool and calculated and rational. And it's fascinating to me that it's called Ethics, because he starts out with this metaphysical system and really builds it into kind of an ethical system and a way of life. But in any case, it just strikes me that, you know, this is how Vulcan would do philosophy. Let's define our key terms and let's see what we can deduce using pure reason alone. And, I'm cracking the book right now for the first time, and it's fascinating. The very first thing, part one, it says, concerning God, and there are, the very first section is definitions, and he starts out with six definitions. And I'm going to read just one or two of these, because they just give you a flavor, and I can totally envision, I can envision Spock, or I can envision Sarek, you know, any sort of stoic, cool-sounding Vulcan that we see in Star Trek reading these lines. So the very first definition inside this book is, by that which is self-caused, I mean that whose essence involves existence, or that whose nature can be conceived only as existing. It's like, whoa, it's already really, really heavy, right? It's just, if you sort of start out by thinking of God as a self-caused cause, he says, okay, well, what is something that's self-caused? Something whose essence, its being, involves existing. It has to exist, a necessarily existing being. He says, okay, that's definition one. And he goes into a few more of these, and he deduces this grand metaphysical system based only on a few definitions. So it just strikes me that, you know, other than the God issue, aside, of course, you know, Spinoza's in the Western Judeo-Christian tradition, but it mm-hmm. just strikes me that Vulcans would do philosophy very much like this. Let's define some key terms and see where the logic goes.
Yeah, Zachary, I find it fascinating. You mentioned Spock talking about logic being the beginning of wisdom. And I don't know if it was a happy accident, but that's almost a direct quote from the Christian Bible, in which we're told that it is the reverence of God, which is the beginning of wisdom. And so I'd love to pull some writers in here sometime and ask some of these questions. I find it fascinating. You know, here is Spock, almost a direct quote, but rather than saying that it is the reverence or fear, whatever action you want to put in there, I prefer the term reverence. Reverencing God being the beginning of wisdom, Spock simply replaces that by saying logic is basically the beginning of wisdom, not its end.
It's funny you say that, because it almost seems like you can take these well-known phrases from the Judeo-Christian tradition, and there's certainly no shortage of Eastern philosophy in Vulcan sure. philosophy too. You can take any one of these phrases or quotes, pull God out or pull the important spiritual term out, put logic in, and you've got a perfect Vulcan quote. I hadn't thought about that. Now I want to put together like a whole bumper sticker series of these.
Yeah. Well, Zachary, I think you're onto something, you know, when you talk about replacing, you know, God with logic, because after all, I think to a great degree, with Vulcans, logic really is their pursuit, much the same way for the Christian Christ would be their ultimate pursuit, or someone who's Jewish, it would be Torah or Yahweh being their ultimate pursuit, or the Buddhist, it's the wisdom, the teachings of Buddha being their ultimate pursuit, or, you know, with the Muslim, it would be Allah or whatever, the Muhammad. What basically we're looking at here when we're talking about logic in the circle of Vulcans, it is their ultimate pursuit. For the Borg, it's perfection. For the Vulcan, it's logic. For the Ferengi, it's gold press latinum. But nevertheless, we're talking about an ultimate pursuit, and logic certainly represents that for the Vulcan, which is a very spiritual concept and not so much an intellectual one.
But see, this is where Spock is proving himself to be contrary to most Vulcans, right? Insofar, if the hypothesis is that logic represents that ultimate pinnacle for most Vulcans, here comes Spock in Star Trek VI saying logic is not the end of wisdom. Logic is just the beginning. It's just a tool, in other words. It's not something to strive for its own sake. Well, I mean, the thing is, Spock is not your average Vulcan, right?
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely he's not your average Vulcan. Back to my statement when we first got started talking about quintessential Vulcans, our quintessential Vulcan is not purely Vulcan. He does wrestle with emotionalism as his human half tries to assert itself.
Mike, I want to unpack this phrase by Spock that Valeris needs to have faith that the universe will unfold as it should. But before we do that, I want to get your reaction to that scene in Star Trek VI. That scene always jumped out at me as particularly interesting because it's the perfect juxtaposition of the different facets of Spock's personality, his ability to synthesize those facets together into something that's uniquely him. But, you know, we've never talked about this before until right this minute. What was your reaction to that scene in particular in Star Trek VI?
Well, first of all, you know, the thing that I appreciate about that particular scene is something that doesn't have as much to do with what he said as it was the fact that there was Spock mentoring another Vulcan. And the thing that I find fascinating about that is the fact that, again, Spock is not your prototypical Vulcan. He is a man of two worlds, and he wrestles that logical side of him and that emotional side of him. And so my initial reaction when I the very first time I saw that scene was seeing him in a mentoring type of relationship. And then to what he said, the thing that I find fascinating about that is it's so far removed, I think, from the Spock that we first met in the original series. The fact that he does have this idea that everything is going to unfold as it should, which suggests philosophy of determinism, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's the main connection I wanted to make. It seems like, you know, as I latch onto these individual threads of Vulcan philosophy, okay, we've got the logic thing. Vulcans are logical. We've got the suppressed emotions. We've got Spock here in Star Trek VI saying that we need to have faith that the universe will unfold as it should, which does, like you just pointed out, connote determinism to me. Mm-hmm. You've got this infinite diversity and infinite combinations. And you wrap all that together, and I sort of go, that sounds exactly like a lot of the things Spinoza is saying inside this book, Ethics. And so yeah. I really kind of wanted to unpack it. It's like, okay, what does it mean for a Vulcan to have faith that the universe will unfold as it should? Well, it's stoic. I mean, there's this kind of thread to the progression of the universe. You can always, and whenever there's a movement, you know, a political movement or just a direction things are going, and say at work or whatnot, you can push against it or you can go with it. And, you know, there is kind of this letting go aspect of it, you know, stop trying to control the movement and just go along with the flow. But it got me thinking that insofar as it relates to Spinoza, I'm just trying to think, what is the way of weaving together this idea of infinite diversity with determinism, with the logic? And this is essentially what Spinoza is trying to do inside this work, Ethics. His fundamental assumption, he starts out trying to analyze this idea of substance or matter or, you know, I mean, this, you got to remember, this is taking place right inside the Enlightenment, where scientific progress is going on. And we have this notion of matter as a substance in the sense of something that exists kind of on its own. It doesn't seem to depend on anything else for its existence. And so he starts out by trying to analyze this notion of substance. And he says, well, okay, if a substance is, you know, by definition, something that exists on its own, doesn't depend on something else for its existence, it's unbound in that sense. You know, he kind of reaches this interesting insight. He says, well, if a substance is by definition unbound, there can only be one of them, because if there were more mm-hmm. than more than one, they would bind each other. They would limit each other. They wouldn't be infinite, right? So he right. says, insofar as there is a substance, there can only be one substance, and it has to be unbounded. It has to be infinite. And that, you know, for Spinoza, that's God, right? The one infinite thing is going to be God. But what, right. what's interesting, he says, well, there can't be any limits on it. There can't be any bounds. There can't be any boundaries. There can't be any inside or outside. It's got to just be one substance that is infinite and unbounded. And so Spinoza, without going through all the, you know, little the Euclidean geometric proofs that he goes through inside the Ethics, his basic insight is that, well, look, if there's only one substance, that means anything that exists at all has to be an aspect of this one substance. So everything you see in the physical world, every person, every animal, every tree, every bush, every thought, every future action, everything in the past, all of that has to be aspects of this one substance that he calls God. And so Spinoza, he was really branded as a heretic by the Catholic Church, because he is basically saying there's no such thing as God as a creator outside of the universe. You know, the traditional Judeo-Christian view is that God is outside of creation. There's the universe and all space and time and everything in it, and God, separate from that outside, is a creator of the universe. But Spinoza is saying, look, there's only one substance, and everything has to be an attribute of that substance. So he's equating God with everything in the universe. He's saying there's really no distinction between the two, that all these things that look like they're finite substances or matter to us are really just attributes of this one infinite, unbounded substance that he calls God. And so, you know, you can start to see the threads of Vulcan philosophy here. Okay, you've got infinite, right? You have unbounded infinity that connotes shades of infinite diversity and infinite combinations. If all the future is laid out as just an attribute of this one infinite unbounded substance, you can see the determinism element in the philosophy. If all the future is just sort of laid out as attributes of God as an infinite substance, so. You know, you just start to see these threads of Vulcan philosophy, you know, popping out here. There's this phrase from Spinoza. It's a Latin phrase, Deus sive natura, which basically means God as nature. And, you know, last week on Metatrex, you and I talked about the environmental movement and animal rights. Specifically focusing on Star Trek IV and the Save the Whales movement. But it's in Spinoza that you can actually see the seeds of the environmental movement, because if all of nature is identified with God as this one infinite substance, that is the seed for, you know, having some sort of spiritual connection to not just God as a creator of the universe, but everything in creation as having some sort of spiritual aspect to it. So, you know, Vulcans would be like the prime examples of environmentalists on this view, maybe.
Yeah, and another place that we get to see a little bit of that is in the character of Chakotay in Star Trek Voyager. His Native American heritage, in which Native Americans were thought often to be worshippers of nature. They were pantheists, and their worship of God was God as revealed in the natural world around them. And so they saw animals and you know, things in the natural world as actual spirits that were there to minister to them and were deserving of their worship.
Yeah, you use the word pantheism and you hit the nail exactly on the head. You know, Spinoza is basically saying there's no distinction between God and creation, or things in, you know, individual things in the world, animals or objects or anything, right? So it's pantheism in the sense of God being everywhere and everything. And so you're right, Chakotay and some Native American philosophy has that pantheistic element to it. What's interesting to me, though, is I kind of contrast this view, and it's sort of we're sort of making Vulcans out to be pantheists here. But does that mesh up with what we see of Vulcan philosophy and theology inside Star Trek V, when Spock's half brother goes looking for Shakari in the place of creation, you know, what we would call Eden? in Star Trek V. Is that pantheistic in that sense, or are we reading way too much into Vulcan philosophy? And it's possible that Vulcans just are presented in different ways in Star Trek, and they really don't have a coherent philosophy in universe. That's entirely possible too.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what makes Vulcans very interesting, is that they are portrayed in many different lights. And I think if there's one thing that we learn about Vulcans is the fact that they are very much more diverse, I think, than what most of us as fans think. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Cybok. I think there's a good example. I think about one of my favorite episodes of Enterprise, Fallen Hero. That particular episode, presents a character that's very atypical of the Vulcans of her time. And what makes her character so fascinating is that she is charismatic. She is interested in other cultures, and she emulates to some degree whatever culture she's in. I think about, for instance, I believe it's Stigma in Enterprise, where we have, this Vulcan crew that is trying to embrace both their emotions and logic. And so, they are not vegetarians, and they are much more open to, emotionalism. We see in the original series, some diversity among Vulcans in Voyager. It's interesting because Tuvok, who is very much a Vulcan, we see different shades of his character that aren't necessarily always stoic, although he puts up a good front. You see that there are times when the circumstances are going on around him, wear on him, and he becomes very expressive. And so I think throughout the Star Trek universe, we do see some diversity there among the Vulcan people, which I think, honestly, Zachary, is that expression of Edic.
As I think more about the meaning of Edic, or infinite diversity and infinite combinations, it occurs to me that there are sort of two ways you can read that. There's kind of a lighter, less deep way of reading it, and there's sort of a deeper, I want to say more spiritual, but at least a deeper, more significant way of reading that. I think on the lighthearted reading of Edic, you could make Vulcans out to be something like cultural anthropologists, right? They recognize that in the universe, there's a bunch of diversity. There's different worlds and different cultures and different races and different ways of doing things, different practices, different ethical views. And so, you can kind of picture Vulcans as meandering around the galaxy doing this cultural anthropological survey, much like they're doing of humans. They're curious when humans invent warp drive and they decide to, the Vulcans decide to change course and land on the planet to kind of check out what the humans are doing now that they've got warp drive in mm-hmm. Star Trek First Contact. That's kind of interesting. They're sociologists or they're anthropologists in some way. I don't think that really does justice to the meaning of Edic for Vulcans. And if my hypothesis that you can read Spinoza into Vulcan philosophy and vice versa. In fact, now I kind of want to go back and read all of Spinoza's Ethics, which is a massive book. It's not a little book. I mentioned that it's proof after proof and definition and axiom after definition and axiom. It's really kind of a tedious book to read in that way. But now I kind of want to go through and I just want to read Vulcan philosophy into the whole thing and see if I can picture how Vulcans would interpret it. But so the deeper way of reading it for me is that, well, if the Vulcans have latched onto this idea that that something infinite has to be unbounded and it has to have infinite attributes, and all of those attributes are harmonious and they're all there by design or by necessity, they couldn't be otherwise, then anything inside the universe, anything inside that one substance, and of course, in Spinoza, it would be anything that's sort of inside or by definition co-consistent with God as this one substance. But for Vulcans, let's just say the one infinite substance. You know, if everything is an attribute of that or is a component of that, and everything is that way exactly as it should be, and it couldn't be any otherwise because it's there by necessity, then everything in the universe is entitled to some sort of deep spiritual reverence. You know, that diversity that you see of, mm-hmm. you know, races and cultures and ways of being and whatnot is not just, you know, culturally, anthropologically interesting, it has this spiritual component, even for Vulcans, because they recognize that it's that way, that diversity, that infinity is there, or that infiniteness, that infinite diversity and infinite combinations is there kind of by necessity. It couldn't help but be otherwise.
Yeah, there's another thing that I think bears mentioning, Zachary, and that is this idea that this isn't the natural default for Vulcans. I believe it's the Voyager episode Random Thoughts, another great Vulcan episode, really. We learn a lot about, for instance, the telepathic abilities of Vulcans. And honestly, up until that episode, I don't think I really ever knew that Vulcans were capable of telepathic communication. But, you know, in speaking to the chief examiner in that particular episode, Tuvok, in answering some questions that she was asking, lets on, you know, what many of us as fans already knew, and that is that that Vulcan history was one of great violence and emotionalism among his people. And so this was part of an awakening movement in which, as a people, they began to embrace logic and learn to suppress their emotions. So I think it bears mentioning here that this isn't necessarily the default position for Vulcans, which I think lends itself to the idea that this is more of a spiritual thing and not necessarily part of the natural state of the Vulcan people.
I think everything you just said is really kind of helping make my own case to myself that the connections between Vulcan philosophy and what you see in Spinoza's ethics is mm-hmm. The connections are deep and they're nuanced. So you mentioned telepathy. And so, for example, if it's possible for more than one being to communicate together telepathically, non-verbally and, you know, and whatnot, that connotes to me that there's obviously some sort of mechanism for doing that, some sort of connection mind to mind, even despite distances in space and whatnot. And on Spinoza's view, of course, different people, different minds, different brains, different whatever, are all just attributes of the one same substance. So they're kind of connected by definition, according to Spinoza. Now, you don't want to read Star Trek into Spinoza, or Spinoza's not saying that sure. people are telepathic, right? That's a Star Trek radically Star Trek interpretation of Spinoza, but it makes sense though. I think if all people and all minds are just different attributes of the same substance, then that's a mechanism for explaining telepathy that's never really explained in Star Trek. They don't really explain the mechanism where telepathy happens, sort of like touch telepathy with Vulcans. But mm-hmm. But you also mentioned that this Vulcan stoicism or the suppression of emotions is not the default for Vulcans, right? Their default state was to be warlike, to be aggressive, to be highly emotional, and whatnot. You know, basically, you know, with the Romulans.
Klingons you know. With pointy ears.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Klingons with pointy ears. I love it. So, Mike, right now I'm looking at this book, Ethics by Spinoza, and it's, you know, 300 or 400 pages long. And at the very end of the first part, you know, on page 40 something, you know, in the appendix to the very first section, Spinoza says, "I've now explained the nature and properties of God." Like, you know, he just lays it out. Like, I've spent 10 pages now, I've explained everything there is to know about God. But so it's this sort of deeply metaphysical book, and yet the book is called Ethics, and that is an interesting dichotomy to me because at the end, by the end of this book, Ethics, Spinoza basically comes around to saying, "Look, we as humans are emotional creatures, and we have the ability to fight against the natural order of things. You know, mm-hmm. we can beat our head against a wall and cause ourselves a lot of stress and heartache and dissatisfaction and whatnot. Or we can be more harmonious with nature, more harmonious with the natural order of things, more harmonious with the flow of the direction things seem to be going in time. and we can put our emotions at ease. And it's not that we become emotionless like we do for like we see in Vulcans, but there is kind of this suppression of harmful emotions. That if you're harmonious with all of those things, that God as the one substance, the direction things are going, not causing yourself harmful emotions or going against the grain too much, then you can live harmoniously and have emotions that are beneficial to you and beneficial to the universe and are not harmful and not stress causing and whatnot. So there kind of is this suppression of really harmful emotions in Spinoza that to me really does echo this suppression of emotion in general that you see from Vulcans.
And you know what I find really fascinating about that is that as someone who is a spiritual person, one of the disciplines or virtues, if you will, of spiritual life, at least for a Christian, is that we, in terms of Scripture, we're taught to eschew or to push away what is evil and to embrace what is considered good. And so in that regard, there's some parallels here, if you will, between the Vulcan idea of Idic and human spirituality.
So Mike, as I continue kind of thumbing through Spinoza's ethics here, I'm just trying to stop on some passages that strike me as particularly interesting. And I just stumbled on one that strikes me as something that I could hear Spock saying, in this discussion with Valeris or any other discussion really where Spock is, finding the right balance between emotion and logic. So this is also from Spinoza's Ethics. Towards the end, after Spinoza's basically reached this Vulcan-esque conclusion that, it's important to suppress harmful emotions, he says, "As long as we are not assailed by emotions that are contrary to our nature, we have the power to arrange and associate affections of the body according to the order of the intellect." Yeah, now tell me you can't hear Spock saying that.
Absolutely. Absolutely, I can hear Spock saying
that. I guess what's fascinating is it's not one little thing. It's not just logic. It's not just this idea of infinite diversity. It's not just this idea of suppressing emotions. You put all of that together, combine it with some of this, Spinoza-esque metaphysics or what you could call mysticism, and you get something very much like Vulcan philosophy. And you start to see why for Vulcans it's spiritual and not just logical.
I think you raise a really fascinating point here, Zachary. And I have to wonder, as someone who has an appreciation for philosophy, certainly as someone who is spiritual, and certainly as a Star Trek fan, I've got to wonder just how much, in developing these Vulcan characters, whether it's Gene Roddenberry when he's developing Spock, or if it was another writer who really added the nuances to his character and to the Vulcan people, I don't know. Maybe that's a question for our friend Larry Nemechek. But in developing this culture and these characters, how much were those writers and development folks thinking about Spinoza? Because I can, as you're reading those quotes from Spinoza, I can hear Mark Leonard, or I can hear Leonard Nimoy. I can hear these character actors' voices associated with these quotes.
Yeah, I think this probably falls in the category of, Zach and Mike not doing our homework before the podcast, but this is probably something I should have looked up before we decided to record the podcast today. But the connections are just too numerous. I can't imagine that they've stumbled upon this many nuanced connections to a well-known modern philosopher like Spinoza accidentally. There's just too many connections and they're too nuanced. Before I really took the time to sit down and think about it, I hadn't thought about three or four of these. I mean, these aren't obvious connections, and it's not just one connection. It's not just logic. It's not just the infinity and the infinite diversity. It's not just the suppression of emotions. It's not just the Vulcan spirituality or Vulcan mysticism. It's not just the determinism. You put all that together and it's like, wow, okay, someone really did like Spinoza when they were coming up with Vulcan. So it is a great question for Larry Nemechek or for a better Star Trek historian than I am, someone who's much more familiar with the actual writing of Star Trek and the history of how the concepts and the characters and races were conceived. But it just strikes me that the connections are too numerous to be accidental.
His brain is gone.
Absolutely. You mentioned earlier, I think your words were relative to mind and body being two aspects of the same thing, the same one, which honestly, that took me to an episode I actually watched recently, Gambit, which is, by the way, another really interesting Vulcan episode. That particular episode deals with an ancient Vulcan weapon, and Picard being the lover of history and archaeology, he recognizes on this particular weapon or this particular archaeological relic, you know, these two figures from Vulcan mythology, and basically what equates the god of death and the god of war. And once they assembled the artifact, they were separated by peace. And of course, you know, at the end of the episode, spoilers, listeners, at the end of the episode, we discover that, you know, peaceful thoughts are the defense against this particular weapon. In fact, I got to be honest, Zachary, when I was watching the episode, and it's probably fifth, sixth, maybe seventh time I've seen this particular episode, but I was watching, and even though I know what happens, I held my breath when, you know, she pointed that thing at Worf, because I after seven times watching this, I still wasn't completely sure that he was going to be able to suppress his aggressive tendencies. Every time I watch it, I'm almost sure he's going to go down. But, you know, that brings me back to this idea of these two aspects, these two natures, if you will, of the same thing. And, you know, back to my original comment about Vulcans being, very, very dualistic the fact that their physiology, all kidding aside, they're very much Klingons with pointed ears.
Well, you know, Mike, we humans have this interesting history of being dualists, right? You know, we tend to think of ourselves, especially in this, you know, modern or postmodern time, as being kind of imprisoned in our own mind, right? There's my body and there's the physical world out there, and then there's my mind. And, you know, in some sense, I'm kind of a prisoner in my mind, and you're kind of a prisoner in your mind. And there's this dichotomy between the world and our mind. And with Vulcans, it just strikes me that, I mean, especially given that they're touch telepaths, right? I mean, imagine what it must be like to be touch telepathic, that in reaching out to touch someone, you know, you get a connection of the minds. You know, it strikes me that Vulcans would not be dualists. That strikes me that they would just be, they would have to, by definition, have a more coherent view of mind and body than we humans have to have. And, you know, we did a previous episode of Metatrex on the nature of consciousness. I can't remember the episode number right now, but you know, we considered various ways of explaining what's the relationship between mind and body, between mental properties and physical properties. Are you, you know, dualist or emergentism and whatnot? We talked about a number of different theories. And it strikes me that Spinoza has a really interesting answer to this question, because if there's only one substance, then the problem of how you connect two different types of beings together, mind and body or mental substance and physical substance, kind of goes away, right? There aren't two substances to connect. They're just different attributes of the one infinite, unbounded substance. And so, again, this is just strikes me as another connection. Insofar as Vulcans are touch telepaths, then kind of they already have this ambiguity about, or maybe not an ambiguity, maybe vagueness about the relationship between mind and body. There's a fluidity between those two concepts for Vulcans that humans just don't have. And that strikes me, again, as really just consistent with this idea that comes from Spinoza, that mind and body are just two different attributes or two different aspects of the one same thing. There's an inherent connection between the two by definition, because they're bounded together by this one infinite substance. So, again, that's just another interesting connection, that seems to come, if not directly from Spinoza, then it's at least consistent with what I see in Spinoza.
Yeah. I think you're referencing Metatrex 13, Spock's pineal gland.
That's the one.
Okay, there we go. You know, it's interesting when we're talking about this idea with as far as Vulcans having or having or not having this kind of dual, this kind of inner monologue, inner battle going on. And, you know, it occurs to me that I just got a great idea for a Star Trek comedy in which, and they're very popular, you know, you're having an interaction between two characters and one of them has this kind of, you know, fantasy thought that gets played out on the screen, you know, where they're having a particularly boring conversation with, you know, the other person. And then all of a sudden they kind of stop and there's this fantasy sequence and, you know, they pull out a frying pan and, you know, beat him half stupid or something. So I could just see Tuvok in particular, you know, having a conversation with Neelix and you break to the sequence and you get to see what's actually going on in his mind while he's suppressing his emotions. He's, you know, he's thinking about, you know, dragging Neelix, you know, and throwing him out an airlock or I think it would be a funny, funny comedy, you know, the real Vulcans or something like that.
Well, you know, Vulcans are a little schizophrenic. They have to be, right? You know, if they're trying to spread. Yeah. And I guess that's, you know, again, that's kind of the point that Spinoza's making inside his ethics that, you know, if you let your emotions run unchecked, then that is kind of schizophrenic making. You know, there's a harmonious way of dealing with your emotions in a more holistic, more, you know, I'm trying to think what the right term is, but and more genuine, more consistent with the reality of things kind of way. And then there's a way of letting your emotions kind of run out of control and creating all the chaos you'd expect, all the drama you'd expect, right? Yeah, I mean, you have to have some of that to have an interesting drama, right? So I love the idea of an out of control Vulcan sitcom, but.
Well, that's just it. They wouldn't be an out of control Vulcan. These would only be like fantasy sequences.
Okay.
and then you cut right back to that stoic, you know, look on his face after he's had this fantasy sequence of bludgeoning Neelix, you know, half to death. I think that I think that's what I appreciate about the way the series Enterprise dealt with the Vulcan people, because I think we got to a really good degree a picture of the Vulcan people really at a crossroads in their culture. You know, it wasn't until the fourth season in the episodes The Forge, Awakening, and Kirshara when Surok's Katra arc was found, and you know they've got the teachings. They have the teachings of Surok, and this kind of is the beginning of this golden age for the Vulcan people. You know, that takes place, you know, 80 years before the original series, and so we get to see a different kind of Vulcan, a Vulcan that's a little more on the surface. And one of the things that I really appreciate about Jolene Blaylock's handling of her character to Paul is that she very much was a Vulcan who wore her emotions on the surface. She didn't always have it in check, and that was even before you know, the events in the third season when she became addicted to Trillium.
Well, Mike, you mentioned something interesting to me. You mentioned that the Vulcans were basically having an enlightenment, that, you know, they had their old ways, and then there was kind of a cultural awakening going on. And so now, in my mind, I'm trying to kind of envision what, you know, and the Vulcans are, I mean, again, the Vulcans are a metaphor for us, right? The Vulcans are a stand-in for, they give you a mirror into human failings and human struggles and whatnot. And Spock does this very explicitly as part of his role on the show, insofar as there's a deep reading of the meaning of a Vulcan character in Star Trek. I think Vulcans are a mirror for humans. They reveal what we could be and what's wrong with humans and and what we do wrong. So, you know, I'm kind of envisioning this kind of Spinoza Vulcan mashup in our own cultural awakening. So think about it. You know, think about what our worldview is now, and this is the Western worldview in general. So all of this should sound really familiar to anyone in the Western world. You know, we tend to think of ourselves as mind as opposed to our body. We tend to think of objects in the world as having their own permanence and being separate from us. Every object in space is its own little bubble, its own substance. It has its own being and its own nature that we can study with science, and we're not connected with it in any deep spiritual metaphysical way. You know, each object is just out there, and then, you know, part of science is going out there and, you know, discovering what we can about it. Now, I'm trying to envision, you know, what it would mean to really kind of take these Vulcan/Spinoza ideas seriously. What would it mean to take literally the fact that everything that we see in reality is bound together in one infinite substance? What would it mean to recognize that there's no fundamental difference between your mind and your body, that they're just different aspects of the same thing? What would it mean to treat other people or other cultures like we are really just identical, that there's no separation, that we're part of the same being, we have part of the same nature. There's no such thing as separateness in that sense, because we're all connected together in this one infinite being. You know, if that is the deep underlying metaphysics of Vulcan philosophy, if that comes from Spinoza, that to me, you can see why Spinoza's book is called Ethics, right? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to think of reality in that way? How would that affect how we treat each other? How would that affect how we view ourselves? And I don't have an answer to this question, but I think it's hard for Western people who have this very sort of rationalistic, dualistic way of thinking about themselves in relation to other people, in relation to the world, in relation to, you know, objects in the world, maybe even relation to God if you're a theist, right? You know, there's a separateness. Each one of those things is its own entity with its own nature, and they're not identical in any way. They're separate. And yeah. So what would it mean to have a deep metaphysical connection to all those things? It's not just a metaphor. I mean, if that's real, you know, Spinoza seems to be saying that's the way reality is, because by definition, there can only be one substance. And if Vulcans have latched on to something like that, you know, just what should our approach to other people or other beings or other cultures be in that worldview, if you take that literally and seriously and not just an interesting metaphor?
Well, I think that's the question right there. You're definitely onto something. And I think that it is very relevant for Star Trek fans. It's a question that I think we do a really good job as Star Trek fans talking about edict. We don't always do the best job demonstrating it. And it strikes me, you know, just think about something very superficial in fandom. Is, you know, the difference in thought between those who consider themselves purists, you know, they are original series fans and, you know, original canon, and then you have, and it's typically, you know, younger fans who are really excited about J.J. Trek, and, you know, some of them have discovered the original series, some of them have discovered Prime Universe Star Trek as a result of the JJ Trek, JJ Verse, but you know they're you know very much fans of that, and so then you have these two camps, and what strikes me about this is that these two camps don't get along. I mean, it's almost ridiculous the way they take these shots at one another in boards out there, you know, on the internet. I check out a lot of the Star Trek boards, and you don't see much of it in the Babel conference, you know, Star Trek, Trek FM's, listeners only, discussion group on Facebook, because we do a pretty good job, you know, making sure that all the conversation, in the Babel conference is respectful. And that really is the key word here. And it drives home my point. Is that the idea of idic is one that is respectful of other ideas and other cultures. And I think that starts very superficially with, you know, those of us who are original series fans or Prime Universe fans, and, you know, those who embrace, you know, JJ Trek, something very superficial, but, you know, you can take that to the, you know, to the next degree. I think about, as I mentioned, the Vulcans and the way they were portrayed in Enterprise. There are a lot of fans out there who get very emotional, as Spock would say, very emotional about the way you know, the Vulcans were handled in the series Enterprise, and the genius, I think, of the way they were handled is the fact that, you know, we got to see them, you know, prior to this enlightenment. We were talking about this in the Turbo Lift. They were jerks. They were jerks. And but they were supposed to be jerks, and I think that was exactly what the creators of Enterprise had intended. You know, it was this you know, pre-enlightenment Vulcan culture. So again, my point in saying all that is to say this: I think the idea of Idik is one of respect. It doesn't mean you know, that we embrace the ideas of other cultures. You know, we certainly all have our own ideas and beliefs, and but at the end of the day, we respect other ideas and other cultures, and we recognize, you know, the important role, for instance, spirituality plays in the life of a person, whether, you know, whether they're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim. You know, we respect the idea that, you know, the spiritual life is very important, or cultural considerations, the way someone dresses or their particular customs, you know, no matter what they are, there's an idea of respect. And I think that really, at the end of the day, is Idik, and it's something that is not always presented well, but oftentimes is presented, you know, pretty straightforward in the Star Trek universe.
As you were talking just now, Mike, I was thinking back to our discussion last week about whales and environmental ethics and animal rights. And I remember you saying something last week that comes to me now. I remember you saying that you look in the whale's eye and you see intelligence and you see self-consciousness, self-awareness, whatnot. And it occurs to me that, you know, that kind of environmentalism, you can find seeds of that in Spinoza here, because, mm-hmm. you know, if you look at another being's eyes, you look in the whale's eyes and you see something of yourself, you see a connection. You don't just see something that you respect. You see that you're bound together in some way. You see something of yourself in that being. You know, there's a deep kind of connection there if you read it even just a little bit metaphysically, like Spinoza does. You know, and I apply that to what you're just saying now about people who disagree. You know, yeah, okay, Star Trek fans disagree with each other sometimes, and maybe they let it devolve into an argument sometimes. But that's just a microcosm of human life in general, right? People,
oh, yeah.
There are factions and wars and whatnot. But if you take that idea that if you look at another being and you recognize a substance in their eyes, right? There's a common experience, a common nature. You know, if you read it like Spinoza does, then you're part of the very same substance, or you're all part of God as nature, as Spinoza would say. But in Vulcan philosophy, you're all part of this infinite web of diversity and infinite combinations, right? You know, if you're all bound together in that way, that should affect the way you treat those beings, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, there's an interconnectedness to, you know, to ourselves as we relate to the universe as a whole. And so, again, it's fascinating because there's a deep connection to this environmental topic that we were talking about last week, but it also has this ethical component, how you relate to other beings. I don't think it's what's interesting, I don't think it solves any real problems, right? Yeah, if you suppose, yes, we're all connected in some deep metaphysical way, there's still going to be things you disagree with, there's still going to be things that are right and wrong, and you have to make decisions, and I don't think it actually sort of solves the conundrum of human life. How do you, you know, make decisions and move your life forward and decide what's important to you and what's right and what's wrong and whatnot. I don't think Spinoza is trying to solve those problems for you. But what he seems to be doing is saying, look, there's an orderliness and a necessity to the progression of the universe in its infinite diversity that you can either fight against or you can accept. And if you fight against it, you're going to cause yourself a lot of emotional chaos, just like the Vulcans, we're bound by their emotional chaos until you find a way to let it go or have healthier emotions that are more harmonious with the nature of reality as we've described it here today. And, so it's interesting because I'm sort of just picturing, you know, if Spock were standing here, you know, maybe, you know, the part two of the lecture with Valeris about having faith that the universe will unfold as it should. What would Spock say when he hears these kinds of arguments between Star Trek fans? You know, what would Spock do? He would say, you know, don't you guys recognize you're all part of the same nature? You're connected together in some way. You're bound in this web of infinite diversity. Stop it. Get along and respect each other. But now that we've talked it out, it seems like it's deeper than just respect, because respect sounds like a Kantian approach, right? Where it's like, okay, yes, you're an autonomous being, so I respect you. We might disagree, but there's no real deep connection between us. And for Spinoza, there is this deep metaphysical connection. And I think that seems to be closer to what's going on in Vulcan philosophy. You know, respect sounds very almost cold-hearted, and Kant was very sort of cold-hearted and rational, right? You would say, yes, I'm going to do it out of duty. I recognize the right thing to do in some universal sense, and I'm going to respect you, and I'm going to do the things that are universally right or wrong out of duty, not out of emotions, not out of harmony with nature, not of any of the stuff we've talked about with Spinoza. It's this sort of cold-hearted analytical duty. Whereas for Spinoza, even though he's a rationalist trying to do this Euclidean geometric deductive proof from first principles, that's very much like what you'd expect in if Vulcans were doing philosophy, I think, you know, logical deduction. For Spinoza, it's much more a sense of recognizing this deep interconnectedness. And there is an emotional component to it that is healthy if it's done right. So it's not cold-hearted and logical. I think the cold-heartedness of logic of Vulcan emotion sounds more like Kant to me, whereas, you know, Spock's attempt to integrate the two in Star Trek VI by saying, you know, it's not all about logic. It's logic plus faith that the universe will unfold, and logic plus, whatever else he's learned along his journey. And that's the real end of wisdom. That sounds a lot more like Spinoza to me than this cold-hearted, duty-based ethics of Kant.
It's interesting, Zachary. You made this point a couple of times with Spinoza. It's something deeper. It's metaphysical. It's a connection. It's something more than respect. It's seeing something of yourself in someone or something else.
Everything. The whole universe.
Yeah, indeed. Exactly. Indeed. Right. And that takes me back to the sixth season of Star Trek: The Next Generation. The episode The Chase, at the end of that particular episode, you know, we discover that all of the species share a common origin, if you will. So really very much, whether you're a Vulcan or a human or Cardassian or Romulan or Klingon, there very much is, something of ourselves and others. You know, I think about, and I don't want to get too political. I don't want to get, too much of current events here in the podcast. But I think about, you know, a lot of the upheaval that's going on in the world. And it seems like every day there's another bombing or another shooting or, one day it's, you know, Pakistan, and, you know, the next day it's somewhere else. And it's getting to the point to where, quite frankly, I think a lot of people are almost becoming desensitized by it. But the thing that really in my mind is so very hard to understand is, you know, when I turn on the news and I see, that kind of suffering going on, and I see, you know, mothers holding their children, and I see, people weeping for their lost and injured loved ones. It occurs to me, Zachary, that that very easily could be me. And in that suffering, I see something very familiar. We're all humans. And I think there's something to be learned here, not just from Star Trek, but from Spinoza, in the way he approached, the idea of ethics, being that we are all connected, that it is something that can be experienced on a much deeper level, beyond just common courtesy.
Yeah, even though Spinoza is a Western philosopher, he's one of the big three Western rationalists. You've got Descartes, and you've got Leibniz, and you've got Spinoza. Mm-hmm. Those are the three big. And then on the other side of the philosophical coin, you've got the three big empiricists, Locke and Berkeley and Hume. We've mentioned all these people on mm-hmm. Metatrex before. But for Spinoza, it just strikes me that even though he's a Western philosopher, he's got this kind of Eastern interconnected component to him. And as I'm listening to you describe the state of the world today, which makes us all weep internally, I think, we all wish the world was better than it is, especially as Star Trek fans, I think, right? There's kind of this sickness to the Western mindset, the Western world in general. And I think you can explain this in Spinoza's terms. Spinoza would say, look, if you think of yourself as a separate being from other people, a separate being from other cultures, separate from nature, separate from the environment, separate from the universe, right? If that's your mindset, that there's you versus everything else, it's very easy to dehumanize everything and not recognize, not give any moral weight to any actions that you have towards any other people at all, and make it all about you, or all about your particular worldview, mm-hmm. or all about your particular religion. And it's this radical kind of lack of connectedness that I think Spinoza would say is creating a lot of the sickness that you see in the world. By contrast, if you don't just recognize other people's autonomy or treat people with respect, but if you're connected to them in some way, if you have this deep metaphysical, spiritual connection to other people, to the environment, to whatever, you're much more likely to treat those beings well. And definitely you're not going to hunt them down and kill them and all these evil things you just described in the world, right? You're not going to do those things if you think you're connected or with other beings or other people in some deep way. In fact, for Spinoza, again, it's not just connectedness; it's that you're just different aspects of the very same being, right? It's this deep, deep metaphysical connection. It's not just respect, not just seeing the humanity in other people. It's that you're part of the very same being. There's God in me, and there's God in you, and there's God in the universe, and all of us together are this one infinite bundle of diversity. And if that's your approach to other people, then you're much more likely to treat people ethically and civilly and with respect and morally and all these things that we've been describing. But if you take this approach where you are mentally isolated from reality at large, mm-hmm. then it's very easy to dehumanize and desensitize and do evil in the world, all in the name of whatever crazy thing is going on in your mind. And that's the exact opposite of what Spinoza said. So, I think Spinoza, even though he's a Western philosopher, he's often kind of cited as maybe not a proto-Eastern philosopher, but there's these heavily Eastern shades of thought that are not Western at all in his thinking. And I think you can explain a lot of the evil that we see in the world in his terms somewhat convincingly.
Oh, I think definitely so. And if we can learn anything from Tuvok's character, it's that it's that we can experience irritation by the Neelixes around us. And
well, it doesn't stop you from being a troll, right? You can still get a rise out of people. Well, Tuvok knows how to do that. So, and so does Spock at his best.
indeed. Well, Zachary, we have rolled past an hour. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, not really. I think I wish I had a lot more time to cover some of the nuances of Spinoza, and I wish I had more time to actually, you know, I think maybe my final thought is just that now I have a project for myself. I've never taken the time to sit down and reread Spinoza's Ethics from a Vulcan standpoint. I've never taken the time to, you know, all the nuances that we've talked about in Spinoza's philosophy, that it's been quite a few years since I've looked at it. It's frankly been quite a few years, but now I kind of want to go through and sort of nitpick Spinoza's philosophies and making even more connections to Vulcan philosophy and see what connections are really there. I do want to pick Larry Nemechek's brain about the actual history of Star Trek and Star Trek writing, and find out whether these connections are accidental or whether they were intentional. I suspect that there's too many connections to be accidental and that it's more intentional than it might seem at first glance. But what's interesting to me, I think, is the nuance. It's that it's not just one or two connections. There's kind of a coherence to Spinoza's overall philosophical system. The way he starts out with his logical deductions, defining his terms and axioms, deducing this big metaphysical system that leads to all these ethical theories that very much mirrors the progression that you described in Vulcan Enlightenment, this idea that Vulcans had to learn to handle their emotions in a certain way. And that's deeply connected to their views on logic, and it's connected to their views on Edic, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. It's connected to their Stoicism. And these aren't incidental connections. And there's a coherency to Vulcan philosophy, and there's a coherency to Spinoza's Ethics, and there's a coherency in their relation to each other that is very interesting when you put all those pieces together into a coherent whole. And if you don't do that, you just have a bunch of isolated threads like, okay, Vulcans are logical and they suppress their emotions and they like diversity, but we don't really know why. But I think we got to give the writers more credit than that. They've latched onto this coherence of that as a worldview, and it's not an accident.
I agree completely. I want to encourage you to take on that project. In fact, I would be more than happy to assist in that. In fact, I think it would be fun, Zachary, to take Spinoza and apply it to other cultures in the Star Trek universe. For instance, the Ferengi. What if the Ferengi began to not completely embrace, but began to embrace
infinite dollars and infinite combinations.
Infinite dollars and well, the Vulcan Edict pin was highly collectible and difficult to acquire in the Bajor sector.
Yeah, and at their best, they're made of gold.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, Quark saw an opportunity there to make a profit in selling Vulcan Edict pins, especially there around the Bajor sector, where they were hard to get. So one could say that was maybe Quark's first step towards embracing Edict. I'm not sure, but that might be a fun way to approach a deeper dive into Spinoza.
Mike, it reminds me of the Ferengi view of the great material continuum. We're all bound together in the great material continuum. So even the Ferengi read their Spinoza.
Yeah. I think that would be a lot of fun to explore. Zachary, I really don't have any final thoughts beyond what we've already talked about. I think there's definitely something to be said here. I don't think it's a happy accident. I think you and I are absolutely correct that there was some purpose in the way that it seems Spinoza's philosophies are woven into these ideas and principles and philosophies that have been embraced by the Vulcan people. And I think definitely we should take another crack at it sometime. Maybe we can meet up with some Vulcans on the holodeck and play a game of baseball and talk Spinoza.
Yeah, I think the thing that's hard about thinking about this issue is that if you focus on any one of these threads in isolation, it doesn't really make sense. It's only when you really kind of follow Spinoza's train of thought, you know, really taking seriously how he's defining his terms, like this idea that substance has to be unbound and uncaused by anything else, and Well, and then the conclusions that he draws, you know, well, that means there can only be one of them. And that means that we're all different parts of the one same substance, just on and on and on. He builds this big metaphysical system. And if you just kind of take any one of those threads on its own, it loses its coherence. Mm-hmm. It's this coherence of this worldview as a whole that gives it some credibility. But that makes it really hard to talk about in an hour podcast, right? You know, what you really want to do is kind of dive in and go step by step by step through Spinoza's reasoning. And then, you know, as it parallels Vulcan philosophy, you don't just want to say, okay, well, let's talk about why Vulcans are logical. Well, it's not just because they had a cultural enlightenment. It might be because they have this deep, you know, spiritual worldview about the interconnectedness of reality, this infinite diversity and infinite combinations. Well, why do they have that? Because so on and so forth. And you can build this really coherent system, you know, with each of these components as a thread or a strand. And I guess my point is just that it's actually really difficult to do in an hour and a half podcast. You really want to sit down and kind of go step by step through the arguments and through the reasoning and spend a little time just kind of immersing yourself in the idea. And I think it's almost like this meditative idea, you know, close your eyes and imagine what it would be like to be connected in some metaphysical way to not just other people, but reality as a whole. The entire universe, the entire galaxy, every being, every, you know, the cup of coffee on my desk, you know, the blade of grass out there out my front yard. And you're all, if the view is that you're all part of the same substance, close your eyes and think, what would that be like? Don't just you know, think about these components of the worldview in individually, diversity and determinism and substance and emotions and whatnot. Put it all together and say, okay, now imagine a radically interconnected universe. What is that universe like? And just kind of, you know, it's like this gestalt shift you have to make from the Western mindset to even understand that. It's meditative in a way. and I think that's why Eastern philosophers like Spinoza so much, because there is this meditative component. You have to, you know, put yourself in that mindset. Yes. And think about reality in a totally different way than you're used to thinking about it in the Western world. And, if I guess for my final thoughts, I guess that's just kind of, it's a challenge, right? Go out and read a little Spinoza and close your eyes a little bit and sit outside under a tree and imagine what it would be like to be interconnected with other people and reality and nature and the environment, the entire universe even, and ask yourself, what is that worldview like? And what should, if that is correct, that worldview, what should our attitude towards nature or the environment or other people or other cultures be if that ends up being correct? And I think that's the deep, deep meaning of Vulcan Edic philosophy, right? It's not just, hey, other cultures are neat and interesting and let's go learn about them like scientists. It's that we're all interconnected in this diversity in some way. What should our ethical and moral attitudes towards that be? I don't have an answer to that, but I think it's a challenge. If you really like Star Trek philosophy and this idea that, as Star Trek fans, we should be tolerant of each other and tolerant of other people and other cultures and, you know, this very optimistic, idealistic, ethically inspired vision of humanity and the universe that you get in Star Trek. Really try to imagine what it's like to live that, right. and not just throw it out there as platitudes, because I think a lot of times it's just platitudes and it doesn't really resonate for our Western mindset. And if you look at it through Spinoza's lenses, you can go, okay, this is a radical shift in worldview. This is not just something that we Western folks can do in the blink of an eye.
And you mentioned something there that we didn't even dive into, and I think we should make a note the next time we approach this topic, is the meditative aspect. We didn't really get into that with the Vulcan people, but it's very much a central part of how they approach this idea of Edic. It is something that is very meditative for them. You were saying there in your final thoughts, you weren't sure, you know, Vulcans, got together and read Spinoza. I've actually got a theory about this. And as we were talking in the Turbo Lift, the day after this podcast drops is April the 5th, first contact day. So what I'm thinking, Zachary, is that somehow, in the middle of a drunken stupor, Zephyrin Cochran gave them a copy of Spinoza. And that's actually what led to the beginnings of the Vulcan Enlightenment. That's just my working theory.
So in Star Trek II, when Spock is meditating in his quarters, he's got his hands together and the Vulcan live long and prosper salute, like he's praying, but with his live long and prosper salute, his eyes are closed, he's in the dark. He's actually trying to recall some Spinoza verses.
Yeah, yeah, that he saw when he was a kid.
Right, yeah, exactly. Must be it.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Vulcan philosophy, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
I want to hear Worf give a command sometime like 1/4 ramming speed. And then yes. Someone says, Captain, regulation specifically states that we cannot go at 1/4 ramming speed while we are in orbit of a planet.
To the journey!
Next one in line is Spirit Folk, and we already agreed that that is just not necessary for anybody, and let's not torture them with it. Good, let's move on.
The characters in the Fairhaven Hollow program begin to suspect the Voyager crew after they witness several supernatural occurrences.
The Ready Room.
You know, because he's appealing to the Ferengi side of Nog, which is still so much a part of who he is.
I'm glad he didn't offer him umox, though.
Yeah, well, whoa. When you said he was going to shack up with Vic earlier, I was like, whoa, it didn't go that far.
The 602 Club.
When people think of Superman, and they kind of immediately, a lot of people think of Christopher Reeves, I think Grant Gustin has that same feeling as The Flash.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no problem. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And, of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website. You can grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. Hey, we really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discuss in this episode of Metatrex, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
To leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
We always love interacting with our listeners on Twitter. It's at Trek FM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm and find us in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference into the search field on Facebook. That's B-A-B-E-L, Babel. Or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
And Zachary, we'd also like to invite our listeners to leave us a rating and review of Metatrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. So Zachary, when you're not sitting meditating with the Vulcan salute in prayerful meditation on Spinoza, where can our listeners find you on Trek FM and around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me in Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. You can also find me on several recent episodes of The Ready Room, Trek FM's flagship show. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not contemplating the unbounded infinite, where can our listeners find you on the network and around the internet?
Well, Zachary, around the network, I am an associate producer for Warp 5, Trek FM's dedicated enterprise podcast. I've been a frequent guest there lately on the interwebs. Facebook, obviously, is the best way to connect with me. You can also find me around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701, and through Instagram, it's cmichael1701. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrex team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, executive producers Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, content manager Will Wynn, our production manager Richard Marquez, and our editor and producer Dennis Castello. Zachary, we'd also like to acknowledge our associate producer, Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick on Twitter at MagicDrop5. Thank you, Patrick, for your support of MetaTrex and of Trek FM. And thank you for listening to MetaTrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
Neelix is better than coffee, coffee substitute.
Every time I hear somebody say that, I see those lumps falling into that cup.
It's pretty ridiculous.
And what gets me is he was so enthusiastic about it. What do Talaxians drink?
Yeah, they
to get jazzed up in the morning?
They take a snack on some dehydrated coffee. Yeah, dehydrated coffee bars.
Dehydrated, you know, we should go into, I bet we could sell those.
You think so?
Dehydrated coffee bars? Yeah. Why not?
Well, it take a lot of coffee. I mean, it's like just eating coffee grounds. It's like the dried coffee ground stuff, you know, like the instant Folgers crystals. It's like taking a, you know, imagine that compressed into a brick.
Yeah, but you could flavor them. You know what I'm saying? You could flavor them.
Sure. You know, vanilla coffee bricks and Irish cream.
Yeah, and you can make them a little creamier. They don't have to be like, you know, compressed coffee grounds, yeah, particle
you can,
board.
You can do a Chief O'Brien style, double sweet coffee brick.
Double sweet coffee brick, dipped in Valerian chocolate. That would be what Deanna Troi would have in the morning, right?
That's awesome.